We're ready to start part two of the fifth epical revelation to mankind. Part two is about the local universe. Starts with paper 32, and that's on old single column, page 357. And before we start actually reading into the paper, for those of you who have a hard copy, there's a title page for the parts of the book that precede each part. Let me just read that little blurb that goes with that title page to part two, entitled The Local Universe. It says it's sponsored by a Nebadon core of local universe personalities acting by authority of Gabriel of Salvington. And I guess maybe just reading that, I'm thinking, think about that in contrast to a very parallel statement at the beginning of part one when it said it was sponsored by a Uversa core of super universe personalities acting by authority of the Orvantine Ancients of Days. So the parallel concept that you have for part one, super universe personalities. For part two, and it's also the case for part three, you have local universe personalities, and not just any old local universe personalities, of course, but our local universe is going to be used as the obvious example of a local universe for the revelation. And in both cases, that revelatory commission is acting under someone's authority. When you're talking about the super universe personalities, it's the authority of the super fathers. The three ancients of days themselves. And when you see acting under the authority of Gabriel of Salvington for this second revelatory commission, you just see a downstepped expression of that authority, linkage that we've mentioned a few times. You very definitively begin to see when a local universe gets settled in light and life. And in many ways, the Creator's Son steps into the background with a lot of the day-to-day activities of a local universe. It becomes much more part of the super universe. And that linkage into the super universe, in this regard, is Gabriel becomes very intimately tied to the Ancients of Days. So you're seeing that fact represented right here. It's not acting by authority of Michael of Nebadon. It's acting by authority of Gabriel of Salvington. Okay, because he is more directly tied to the Ancients of Days. Yeah?
Just bring up an interesting question. Mm-hmm. So if you have the Ancients of Days, giving the, being the authority behind the first part. You got Gabriel on the second part. Who do you think came up with the idea of giving us a revelation in this particular form, in this way, which they say is the first time it's been done in our universe?
You don't have to wonder that. They tell you.
They all got together?
No. Remember, it initiated with the secondary midwares. It all started with that's the whole thing.
Oh, I didn't get that.
Yeah. It all started with the secondary midwares, and they went up the chain of command. They convinced the planetary authorities to petition, and that finally culminated in the Ancients of Days. Now, they don't give you a lot of details. You could suspect that maybe the secondary midwares, had an initial desire that was more limited.
Yeah.
Okay. But the when it finally got up to the Ancients of Days, who had to say yes, they gave a sweeping decree. We're not only going to tell you about some, you know, basic down in the trenches things, like we've been mentioning. We're going to reveal transcendentalers and where they live, and you know, and give you enough clues you can figure out a lot about their origin and history and these sorts of things. Okay, so yeah, it all started out very lowly and ended up in a very grand top-down gesture. So you can kind of the fact that there was such a huge response to what you have a hard time imagining could have been a huge and you know starting point seems to speak to the fact that it was deemed to be part of the supreme, and that it was given the full bidirectional manifestation. It was allowed to flow all the way up to the top, you know, and express vastly as it came down from above, this gigantic revelation. Okay, so. So it seems to have that fullness of relationship to the Supreme. The more you reflect on it, the more you decide that has to be. That's the only explanation for something that is so non-typical. The Supreme would have had to have sort of given credence to this in some way, you know, within the whole of the system. For such a sweeping kind of modification of the norm. Now, again on the revelatory this issue about the revelatory commission. If it's not clear, let's make sure it gets clear right now. That there are three independent revelatory commissions. Okay, that's often lost on a new reader. You have that. you have that commission I was just referring to that's solely behind part one and the foreword. I'll remind us, we ended last time, so we ended part one. We read that little end note in which pointed out that commission, that revelatory commission, consisted of 24 Orvintan administrators acting in accordance with a mandate issued by the Ancients of Days of Yversa. So that first revelatory commission had 24 members. And all of those papers in part one, including the foreword, as I mentioned, were written and totally handled, overseen, authored, the whole works, by those 24. Okay, so that was a very self-contained phenomenon that revelatory commission, they didn't just sponsor those papers, those 31 plus the forward papers. They're solely responsible. They brought those papers into existence in and of themselves. But when you go to parts 2 and 3, which have a separate and the same revelatory commission. There's a new revelatory commission that's sponsors parts, all the papers in parts 2 and 3. A commission of just 12 individuals who are directly tied to our local universe. So just saying that, the 24 people and 32 papers compared to 12 and, you know, how many papers? You have parts 2 and 3. Lots and lots, right? A lot of papers. Those 12 did not, you know, weren't solely responsible for all the papers of parts 2 and 3. Many of the papers in parts 2 and 3, they selected someone, the committee, you know, that commission, that revelatory commission of 12, selected someone, appointed someone to do a certain paper. Now, when we're starting in part two here, with that sponsorship by those 12, it begins with a block of three papers. These first three papers in part two are the ones that give you the general overview of local universes. You know, and certainly, like I mentioned, using our local universe is case in point, because that's the most obvious example, and that's the most relevant to us, of course. But it really is giving you, you know, the general overview of all local universes. What is this? As you drop down out of the super universe domains, you know, what is that next unit about? What are local universes about? That's what those, that's what these first three papers about. And if you look at who authored those, you have it starts out with this first paper. It's a mighty messenger temporarily attached to the Supreme Council of Nebadon and assigned to this mission by Gabriel of Salvington. Oh, okay. So that must be one of the members of the commission, the Revelatory Commission. And you go, oh, and it's not actually a personality, you know, a being who is, you know, born into the local universe of Nebadon. It's one who's assigned here. It's a mighty messenger who's assigned at the highest level, that over that Supreme Council in Nebadon, attached. So he's attached to our local universe. And he gets, you know, Gabriel says, you're going to be on the commission. He does the first paper. You go to the next paper, and you see it's presented by the chief of archangels of Nebadon. And subsequently, you see that it's also obvious that he is on the commission. So the chief of the archangels in Nebadon got put is one of those 12 on the commission. But when you go to the third paper of these three, it says presented by a mighty messenger temporarily assigned to service on Urantia. Okay, that's probably not a member of the commission. That's probably a mighty messenger that's here. And just got appointed to do this paper. Because remember, all the commissions all came here. And so an easy people to appoint to do a paper is someone who's here also, when the commission is here. Sometimes it's directly stated that the author of the paper is not on the commission, that he was appointed. Like, you know, a really trivial one is, you know, one of the papers is authored by our Verandadec observer. You know, and he says, you know, I'm not on the Revelatory Commission. I was just appointed to do this paper. Okay? Okay. So, you know, a lot of, you know, you can suspect that an awful lot of the individuals that, you know, are given a byline for these papers in parts 2 and 3 are not actually on the commission. I mean, it may be the case that maybe there's some of those members of the commission that didn't write any paper. Maybe they were just part of the sponsorship. You know, we don't really know. But, you know, that fact that it goes from something that is much more tightly self-contained with part one and that commission of 24 to something that starts getting to be more delegated and more individuals involved. See, notice how that matches the whole structure of the Revelation and its top-down structure. And as you go from the top down, you're going from unity to greater and greater individuality. Okay, and so more and more it's going to have to fan out, more individuals are involved to engage the greater, you know, complexity of the individuality that needs to be discussed. And have it be presented truthfully. They're too high a being. They won't know of that which they speak. They would not write a paper that would be true. So every paper, you know, has an author that's signed very precisely so that that presentation can be as grounded and true as, you know, as possible. Okay, and you just see this process, and then of course there's the third Revelatory Commission. Are the midwares, you know, that are behind part 4. So there's those three Revelatory Commissions. You know, have their own internal structure. They're you know, and it's occasionally you see them referring to each other, and you can tell that they're, you know, they're independent commissions. And so the beauty with which the whole revelation comes together in, you know, with such consistency, again, speaks to how if any individual is thinking the truth, is following the truth, is attuned to the truth, coincidentally, those beings will all be on the same page. Okay? You want to appreciate that the naturalness with which very separate parts of the revelation can be spot on tied together, and that they wouldn't have had to have had extensive meetings, you know, going round and around about what terminology to use so that we use the same terminology. They're all going to coincidentally, you know, speak the same way, because it's the truthful way for it to be said.
Chris, when, okay, you know, yep, like part one, they talk about saying, well, this will be discussed. Basically, they don't say part two necessarily,
yeah,
but
right,
there'll be another thing.
Right.
So you think they kind of all had a pretty good picture of the whole thing before they started out, so to speak? Because if they're familiar with what's going to be happening from another commission, from this commission, mm-hmm, they must have cahooted in some.
Well, the I don't know if that's a verb, but but they, what's the most basic way that they would have had the framework so that they all basically knew where their domain of assignment was? There's the revelatory mandates that come down from the ancients of days, have this whole structure. You know, and he would have, you know, the ancients of days would have left it up to Gabriel to pick the revelatory commission for parts two and three. But the ancients of days would have told Gabriel, you're going to have, you know, two parts. There's going to be a revelatory commission of 12 that you're going to pick. They're going to talk about these basic things. Now, we also know that, especially by the time you get to part three, you also have the interaction in the back and forth with the humans involved, you know, in further, you know, attuning the subject matter to the recipients. Okay, but the general features would have been, you know, built into the mandates. You know, they would have been. Okay, so no, that's okay. Anyway, I wanted to spend a little time on this because before we just jump in, it's very important to keep the big picture in mind as you're reading, so that you understand, as they pointed out so definitively in, what is that, paper 19, I'm pretty sure, when they talk about origin, history, and destiny, you remember that section? And when they're talking about the Trinity teacher sons, that the only way for you to keep, you know, how do you want to say that? Sort of keep yourself in the right space, the correct space, so that over time you can come into truer and truer relationship with the revelation, is if you definitively keep that background framework in mind. You know, remind yourself what you're attempting to engage. It's you're attempting to engage this very top-down phenomenon that is becoming ever the more individuated as it goes down. And you want to strike step with that structure. you know, if you don't appreciate that, if you, for instance, think that it all comes together rather than being the bottom of the ever more fanning out phenomenon, if it all comes together instead, you think, in part four, and you try to start there and extrapolate that up, mm-hmm, to the top, by and large, every thought you have will be false. You know, and that they tell you that point blank again in that in the first section of paper 19 there. That's a very problematic thing to do in attempting to engage the greatest challenge that humans have ever faced in the history of humans on this world. It's sitting in my lap. It's the greatest challenge we've ever been confronted with. Yeah, of course in blessing, but it's only a blessing if you can succeed in the challenge. If you fail in the challenge, it'll become a curse. You can go into much greater error than it's ever been possible for humans to go into in the wake of the revelation. Him who much is given is much expected. So it's very important to appreciate, you know, where the source is. We're not the source. The source is on high. And to try to strike step with that top-down perspective. You know, it's why we read it in sequence like this, so that we can ever keep that in mind. Okay, so, a little point of cosmology. Remember what we have here. We had a super universe, and within that super universe, you have 10 major sectors. And then within each major sector, you have 100 minor sectors. And then within each of those minor sectors is 100 local universes. And we've come down now again to the word universe. So we now have one turning again. We've gone from a whole, the super universe, to parts that weren't universes, sectors. But we've re-achieved a whole again. And so not only are they going to give you a little bit of sort of just the basic cosmology of the picture in these initial papers, but they're going to, you know, a big feature of these first three papers is, why is it a universe and not just some sort of part, you know, some part name chosen for it? Why? What makes it a universe? It's because there's a creative mother spirit. There's an individuality for a whole. And so that's the third of the three papers, you know, talking about the creative mother spirit. And the direction that's within that whole, the creator son. So you're going to talk a lot about the creator son and the creative mother spirit, too, in these first three papers. Because they're, you know, that's fundamentally what makes a local universe. Yep.
Can you expand on that? You spoke of the direction coming from the sun, but you didn't really get into the mother spirit. So, can you refer into the mind or universal mind presence?
Yeah, the basic duality that you're thinking of there, in contrast to direction, is place. She establishes the place. She establishes it and maintains it, upholds it. She's the upholder of its universeness. She keeps it whole, maintains that integrity.
Like you used to say in the years ago, the womb.
Right, she's definitely a womb of mind.
Well, now, I thought mother spirits were kind of more... I mean, I understand that. Mm. How's that compare with ministry? She's ministry.
Right, when they speak of her as a divine minister, she's ministering mind, for instance. But that ministry of mind is done in a holistic fashion.
Upholding.
You know, she does the whole local universe at the same time. She doesn't, use... channels of energy to minister that mind or whatever. You think of it all being ministered at once, you know. And in terms of that place, I mean, you go, well, where's the boundary of the local universe of Nebadon? It's not, you don't find the boundary of the local universe of Nebadon by looking at matter and go, well, here's an astronomic system here, and then there's a big gap, and then there's an astronomic system over there. The boundary must be between those two systems. That's not how you find the boundary of the local universe of Nebadon. You find the edge of her body. where her presence ends, it ends. She defines it. So, very literally, see, in that sense, she's place. She is the place within which all this occurs. And we'll get to that, obviously, a lot more when we get to paper 34. But let's start with, in this first paper, they are going to give us a little bit about the, the physical structure of a local universe. And we can think a little bit more clearly about how that fits into the picture that we started developing, back in papers like paper 15 about the cosmology.
So, if the area of the universe we're in is defined by her body, then could a person sort of relate that to the idea in the Bible where they mention, I realize they say him instead of her, they say, in him we live and move and have our being.
Right. Right. And you know that from the very beginning of the book, they quote that line. They quote it and they reinforce it. And finally, when you get to the Supreme Papers, they say, now we think you're ready for the technical detail of that. What's the precise truth of that statement that you know so well and you've seen us as revelators hold up many times? Does that refer to God the Father? No. Technically, that's God the Supreme. And even more technically, it's the womb of the grand universe. It's not the he thing, the Supreme Being. It's the she manifestation. It's the universal mother.
But they had it right.
In.
Partially. They right. Inside of a.
Yes. In. You know, if you say, okay, so it's not the universal father, it's the downstepped expression of the universal father at the supreme level, it's the supreme being. But then that transcendental he downstepped into the finite. So in that sense, in him, but when he's downstepped, he becomes she,
right.
You know, and a ubiquitous presence instead of a point being.
Concept.
Okay, right. There's a truth. See, that's what they try to get you to see. If you think about it coming top down, you can see the truth of that statement. Okay? And then you can engage it factually and not just merely truthfully and appreciate it directly factually, that it's the universal mother's ubiquitous presence that we're all, as finite beings, divine counselors and mortals alike, all of us are within her, you know, in her we live and move and have our being.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, in the same way they do the same thing with, the acts are ours, the consequences of God's. They let you play with that in an evolutional sense where you, as a gentle on-ramp, and then finally when you get to the Supreme Papers, they think, okay, now you're ready to handle it precisely and literally. Technically, it's not the Father we're talking about there. Again, it's the same thing. The consequences are God the Supremes, not God the Fathers. All these gentle processes that they spread out over, most of the first three parts of the book, trying to get us transitioned from our initial monotheism and its identification in the first five papers with, the actual God the Father, and then slowly evolving that into a precise recognition that an awful lot of what is immediate about God is not the Father. And if you want the biggest footprint, what you're looking for is God the Supreme. And if you want what's intimate, what's immediately in contact with you, you're not looking for any sort of a God of transcendence, any sort of a He. What you're actually looking for, and what you've been really searching for so long, and been trying to satisfy yourself with a he concept, it's a she that's what you've been actually looking for. And a handful of you in the East have kind of had initial tinges of this, but you didn't take it to personal. It was impersonal for those of you who have a Hindu or a whatnot tradition.
So I think that's one of the elements we have to deal with in trying to get the Urantia book to mainstream Christianity, is they have a tendency to just think of God as one, and not
dealing so much with the different aspects and elements of God that the Urantia book tells us about. And because really all it does is make what it, what the Bible already says just more understandable.
Yes.
To me anyway.
Right. But it's only when you are ready to handle the idea of God. You know, I've tried to stress this some recently. One of the mandates of the fourth epical revelation is forget about the idea of God. Just focus on the ideal of God, of his infinite eternal nature. But the very first paragraph of the foreword, all the way to the last sentence in part four of the fifth epical revelation, is saying, no, we're assuming you have the ideal part in the foreword. Now it's about the idea of God. And that means everything we say is going to be a direct challenge to every idea of every religionist. If it doesn't challenge you fundamentally, you're not experiencing the revelation yet. You can't. The fifth epical revelation doesn't allow you to just stay up there in the commonality of an ideal, especially a very easily commonal, universalizable, infinite, eternal ideal. No, now you have to recognize that basically every idea you've ever had about God is inadequate, or worse.
Yeah, because you can't say it that way.
You can't. Of course you can't. See, that, but see, that's the whole point I've tried to make. You've got to understand this is not a dispensational revelation. It is not even remotely meant to be universalizable. It is not a dispensational revelation. Okay? It is for the handful of people who are ready for the rugged truths. If you water it down so that it's universalizable, it's not the fifth epical revelation anymore. What you're looking for is the fourth epical revelation, which if you don't make the same mistakes that the apostles made, if you do precisely what Jesus told them to do, you have something that's universalizable, the ideal of God the Father, and all of us as, in truth, as children. But that's not the fifth epical revelation. The first thing it says, in the very first paragraph, to every person who would read it is, all of your ideas are confused. Well, if you're not a person who's ready to handle that sentence, then this book's not for you.
Yeah.
You know? And if you're thinking, well, I got to try to somehow hide that or candy coat that, it's like, no. Not if you want to be an evangel of the fifth. Okay. Warning. This is not for those timid souls. Okay.
Yeah, I just think you can't be turning them off right away by saying something like,
but again, don't try to talk to someone that you know the fifth of epical revelation will turn off. Be selective. Look for the person who's hungry for the fifth epical revelation.
Yeah.
Someone who you can speak the truth to freely and openly.
Yeah.
Someone who has courageous and independent cosmic thinking, at least in potential.
Along the parallel lines, if you're with somebody who you mesh with, as compared to somebody who's just coming at it from, I got briefly. I was hitchhiking out of Vegas, and a young fella picked me up in a pickup truck, and we just went on it because we meshed. The young fella and I were coming from the same place, and we just.
It's very helpful if you can. You know, especially early on, if it's not going to be a long-term association, if you can get some personal linkage there, because this is very difficult, and there's going to come a point that person that you're trying to give the truth to has to trust you. If you're going to trust someone, you have to have a personal relationship with them.
Yeah.
You can't trust animal origin creatures. Okay, you can't trust blobs of protoplasm. Yeah.
I was just talking about that today, that the apostles would have never, they had Jesus befriended them. He made them his friend.
Mm-hmm.
And then what he gave them, they accepted it gracefully because, and he befriended all of us with the fourth epical revelation. And now he's giving us the fifth epical revelation and saying, here's what I want you to do with me and for me, the way he did the apostles.
Just stress this. I mean, you remember what, with all of that personal linkage of Jesus to the apostles, that was barely enough to get a tiny little thread of the fourth across, that personal linkage. You understand what we're getting at here. I mean, I'm trying to just stress that, whenever we talk about the big picture of the revelation, like we're doing before we dive into an actual paper here, you know, this is what's in play. Understanding what it is that you're trying to engage here. You're trying to engage something that is going to take every ounce of personality potential that you can muster for you to even acquire a relationship to it. And then how much more is that personality going to be needed to somehow link it to another? You're going to need so much more than Jesus managed to achieve with the apostles. So much more personal linkage. It's like, well, how could I possibly go beyond? You're right. You're going to need, that's what I'm saying, it's a massive challenge to do this. You know, again, the fourth epical revelation is not part four of the Urantia book. That's part four of the fifth epical revelation. Part four is a violation of the mandates of the fourth epical revelation. You know, almost every single page is in violation of what Jesus was telling the apostles, you know, to do. It talks about the things that Jesus said don't talk about. If you're going to try to do what I want you to do, is take out something that's universalizable. This is just not. It's if anyone has any shred of ideology, this is an abomination. There's some place in the book that tells them that their ideology is puerile.
What?
Yeah, that's what this book does. It's not gentle and no. You know, it didn't do like Jesus did, where he tried to be super gentle and just, you know, so that none of the ideological things, you know, would pop up and block him, get in the way of he tried to gently just try to get a hold of the higher, you know, spiritual ideal linkage. There's nothing gentle about this. Okay, so, all right. Let's get into it. And just, those are just points of, you know, food for thought about the revelation. We don't have to solve all those problems right now. But let's get into paper 32 here. Get a little sense of where they want us to, you know, go next here with our trying to follow this challenge of the coming down into the truths of the revelation.
Part 2, the local universe. Paper 32, The Evolution of Local Universes. A local universe is the handiwork of a creator son of the Paradise Order of Michael. It comprises 100 constellations, each embracing 100 systems of inhabited worlds. Each system will eventually contain approximately 1,000 inhabited spheres.
So it's a very basic fact. The very first thing they do is just take it down the rail. Like I said, the free text is you have a super universe, 10 major sectors, 100 minor sectors in each major sector, and then they take it down. You have 100 local universes in a minor sector and down the list. And you guys remember when we were talking about the peripheral paradise? You know, this part of this whole big cosmology that they're laying out. They made a statement there, and they're talking about peripheral paradise that we recognized helps us to understand about this approximately. Why are all these numbers exact? You know, 10, 100, 100, et cetera. Then why is it approximately 1,000? Why isn't it as exactly 1,000? Especially when you notice on peripheral paradise, they say there's exactly 7 trillion of these installations. Not approximately 7 trillion, exactly 7 trillion. Okay. Why is it that in a given local system, you only end up with approximately 1,000 evolutionary origin world.
Revolutionary.
Well,
because some of them don't make it.
Well, but how can exactly 7 trillion match up with approximately 7 trillion? It doesn't match up. Why does it have to be approximately? It's not because of the vicissitudes of evolution. When all is said and done in supremacy, are there any coincidences? No. It has to end up being exactly 7 trillion. You know, 7 billion systems times 1,000, 7 trillion. So what makes up the difference between the inhabited worlds and the final number of 7 trillion? The architectural worlds. There's approximately 1,000 in every local system because you have to include, you know, as part of the eternal structure are all those architectural worlds. Okay? So when all is said and done, coincidentally, the number of worlds through all the vicissitudes that end up being inhabited long-term, when you add the number of architectural worlds to that number, it's exactly 7 trillion. Isn't that a coincidence? No, see, there's no coincidence to it because, there's nothing accidental. And it wasn't micromanaged by an interventionary God either. It's a whole. God the Supreme makes it a whole. It can't do anything but end up with 7 trillion when all is said and done because the whole demands it. Okay, so just a little reminder of that. Keep the whole cosmology picture together in your mind. That's why I've purposely brought that up. We're clear down in the trenches here now with, worlds, but we have to appreciate something they said when we were at the top of the picture on the periphery of paradise. Okay, a little bit more.
These universes of time and space are all evolutionary. The creative plan of the Paradise Michaels always proceeds along the path of gradual evolvement and progressive development of the physical, intellectual, and spiritual natures and capacities of the manifold creatures who inhabit the varied orders of spheres comprising such a local universe.
Okay, and just all evolutionary, who's the God of evolution? God the Supreme. See, again, just so you see that, we've already been talking about this, see? It's a natural part, and that what's evolving is not just physical. It's the threefold actuality that's evolving into a harmony. Okay, so it's physical, intellectual, and spiritual.
Right. Uranship belongs to a local universe whose sovereign is the God-Man of Nebadon, Jesus of Nazareth, and Michael of Salvington, And all of Michael's plans for this local universe were fully approved by the Paradise Trinity before he ever embarked upon the supreme adventure of space.
Okay. Two things, again, that are not a coincidence. Let's take the latter part first. Right there it is. Before he even embarked upon the supreme adventure of space, who did... that Creator Son put himself in cooperative subordination to
the Paradise Trinity,
the whole. So the first thing he does is what his Father did. The first thing the Universal Father did is put himself into cooperative subordination below the Paradise Trinity. He's not going to be the whole. He's going to be a part of the whole. That's what God the Infinite gave up to become the Universal Father. He had to put himself in cooperative subordination to a whole that he isn't. He's just a part now. Very big part, an infinitely big part, but still a part, not the whole. This is done by putting yourself in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity, step one. Okay, and then he proceeds as a descending son to finally come to a process of 7 bestowals. Where he completes the evolutionary leg of this cooperative subordination. He achieves that full relationship, actually then embodies a measure of supreme type deity. And having done that, they refer to him as a God hyphen man. You know, Creator Son is God. Starts out as personalized deity, starts out as God. Why didn't it end up being a man hyphen God? Why does he end up being God hyphen man? Why isn't God the root with man tacked onto it? Why is man the root with God tacked onto it?
That's Trinity
subordination. Right, because he starts as just God, where God is the root. But when all is said and done, it reciprocates. And that which is first becomes last, and that which is last becomes first. You know, when he achieves becoming a master son, he reciprocates his whole nature. And the man becomes the foundation upon which God is built. Okay? That's, you know, again, it's not just because it's easier to say God-man than man-God that that's, you know, it's, everything is technical, okay? That's what that means. The man is the root part of that. And then, see, that's, he turns the whole thing on its head when all is said and done. You know, he reciprocates and starts a new process with a new starting point. With Jesus as the beginning, instead of the Creator Son as the beginning, now what is possible? Well, now he can become, you know, he was God the Supreme seeking as he's descending. He found that measure of God the Supreme with which he can have a relationship and literally embodied it. Then he turns around in the second half of his career. Now he's God the Mother seeking. That's something he doesn't initially possess. As a supreme creator, he's tied to the Almighty. Remember, it's the Almighty part, not the mother part of the supreme, that those supreme creators, we were talking about that just recently, are creating. It's the Almighty part. So he doesn't, you know, initially just have or hasn't yet found the other part, the mother part. So he becomes God the Mother seeking. So while he's going through his second phase and is God the Mother seeking, what are we doing in our second phase as finaliters? We're God the Mother revealing. Remember in the first phase, he was God the Father revealing and we were God the Father seeking. Yeah, see, the two things reciprocated. Our relationships have reciprocated. He can have a second phase because we have a second phase. We can have a second phase because he has a second phase, which is the chicken, which is the egg. No, they're indispensable to each other. In order for him to be God the Mother seeking and eventually have that full relationship in actuality with the ultimate Trinity, and we were talking about just recently, he needs finaliters to be God the Mother revealing. Okay, so there's this whole complex, that's part of the cosmology. I'm emphasizing that. Just to remind you, you know, what they said about the fullness of the system of individuality, the cosmology, that cosmos, that universal harmony, that harmonizing universe, that's a full triune system. The beings are just as important as the things to understand how it all works. Okay, and things and beings need each other. And like we've said, that you will get to experience that for the first time when we get to Havona, and we see how not separate things and beings are on the Havona world, how intimately woven together they are, okay? And how delightful that will be to experience. Okay, so... just reminding you, from step one is this consecration to the Paradise Trinity, and he's going to spend the rest of eternity trying to realize the fullness of that initial oath, basically. You know, that initial consecration that he did on Paradise. From the moment I'm born and forevermore, I will seek to become all the more subordinate to ever greater wholeness. Yeah, because the last thing I want to be is an island universe. Okay. So he's taking that on. Okay.
The sons of God may choose the realms of their creator activities, but these material creations were originally projected and planned by the paradise architects of the master universe.
See, notice how they've broken these up into tiny little paragraphs. It's not inappropriate that we're, you know, stopping so frequently here and hashing it out. They want you to do that. They want you to take this one little nugget at a time. They just stressed the paradise trinity, and then they built upon that. Paradise architects of the master universe. We just read about them. We just, you know, recognized how definitively tied to the paradise trinity they were. Okay? So he takes what seems to be kind of a theoretical, you know, vow of subordination to the paradise trinity. It's like, well, how do you really know that that's, you know, not just a concept? I mean, can you see that literally in action? Yeah, right here. Those representatives of the paradise trinity are above his pay grade. Okay? They, you know, it's projected and planned by the architects, not by creator's sons. So that's the first thing you recognize about local universes. Their wholeness, their universeness, is guaranteed because of the definitive top-down projection. Not only do these architects project downward in this, you know, imposition of the plan, but the mother deity that becomes that whole and that universe is coming down from the paradise trinity. You see, it's all the paradise trinity. See, it's at the top of all this. And it just fundamentally establishes this downwelling phenomenon that establishes every detail in which all the individuals have to, you know, put themselves, you know, into conformity. None of the individuals, even gods, get to dictate the framework. They have to conform to a down, downwardly established framework. Okay, they can do the details. They have free will to handle the details within that framework, but the framework they have no free will control of. It just is. So it's kind of like that relationship between experiential and existential. See, there's always an existential thing that just is. You don't get any free will choice about it. You just have to face it. Face facts and adjust them to ideals. Okay, so that's the basic picture. So, in just that little preface, that's what they're doing. They want to just get you fully in this top-down mode, seeing that, as always, it's the paradise trinity. Don't ever forget, everything you're reading, it all boils down to what's on top, the paradise trinity. You know, and that is what makes this revelation so radically different than that anyone has ever imagined before, because we've all been trying to do a bottom-up thing. And we start at the bottom-up, we're an individual, we make a grand exalted individual, we call him God, and we try to rationalize everything from individuality up. That's what we've been doing, trying to do for a million years. And finally they're saying, nope, now it's time to turn it all on its head. Okay, so we're going to start with the physical stuff. What about the physical part here?
Section 1, physical emergence of universes. The pre-universe manipulations of space force and the primordial energies of the work of the Paradise Master are the work of the Paradise Master Force organizers. But in the super-universe domains, when emergent energy becomes responsive to local or linear gravity, they retire in favor of the power directors of the super universe concerned.
Okay, we talked a little bit about that. Just remind you that. So we're not out in the outer space levels now, where the two different types of force organizers, you know, spin up the worlds and then start condensing them into automatons, and they stay with all those galaxies in the outer space levels, overseeing them. We're now inside the super universe level. Okay, so you still have to have the force organizers starting up the worlds and getting the automatons condensing. But there's some handoff. And I'm sure it varies some depending upon all of the complications. Here they're saying when it becomes responsive to local or linear gravity. Well, certainly, if that was happening in its fullness, that would definitely be an endpoint for the force organizers to be really intimately involved. They may hand it off when you really have just sort of the initial kind of potential being manifested for local or linear gravity. I mean, they could just hand it off the moment that there's automatons, which aren't subject to local or linear gravity because they don't have a mass. Okay, but they do have that initial mass-like potential, which is fundamentally expressed in the fact that they're an individuation. You know, just think about, just philosophically, about local, you know, quote-unquote local or linear gravity, okay? If you're going to have something that you're going to call linear gravity, it's like, well, how would I understand that? Well, I'd probably draw a line, okay? If you're going to draw a line, there's two endpoints of a line, okay? The notion of linearity doesn't make any sense if there are no individuations. If everything is just one whole, you know, ubiquitous something. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to draw a line. It's, you know, it's from nothing to nothing. You know, everything's the same. So you can see that's why the moment you have an automaton, it's like, well, I could imagine two automatons. They're located here and here, and I could draw a line between them. There's at least the potential for something that I would call linear gravity. See, the moment there's individuation. The moment that you have the Isle of Paradise manifesting as a centering influence in the finite, you've got the potential for local linear gravity. So somewhere, you know, between automatons and getting all the way to full-on mass in the electronic level, you have this handoff in the superuniverse level, this handoff between the force organizers and the power beings. Okay, so that's what they're referring to. Definitely once it gets all the way to mass, there's nothing that the force organizers can't touch it anymore. It's out of their reach. Even the transcendental ones can just play on the boundary between the absonite and the finite. So if it gets too far away from the boundary, there's nothing they can do anymore. Okay, and definitely the power beings have to be taken charge. But it's all going to depend on, you know, how much of the world should they condense into automatons, and how much of the world should they leave before they hand it off? Because power beings can't condense the world into automatons. Now, there's some very complicated system here because, you know, there's a whirl to the Milky Way, and these little whirls that are being made get pooled into the big... I mean, who knows how this works? But there's some really complicated system here that they're managing, okay? All right.
These power directors function alone in the pre-material and post-force phases of a local universe. There is no opportunity for a creator son to begin universe organization until the power directors have effected the mobilization of the space energies sufficiently to provide a material foundation, literal suns and material spheres for the emerging universe.
Okay, we'll talk about the details there. They're just, you know, giving you a heads up here to start with that there's a whole bunch of stuff that just the power beings are involved in long before a creator son and a creator mother spirit actually try to set up shop in a quote-unquote local universe. There's all of this precursor stuff that, is the power beings following the architect's plans. They're conforming to those plans. You know, and then a creator son and a creator mother spirit step into that process down the road a ways. Okay.
The local universes are all approximately of the same energy potential, though they differ greatly in physical dimensions and may vary in visible matter content from time to time. The power charge and potential matter endowment of a local universe are determined by the manipulations of the power directors and their predecessors, as well as by the Creator Son's activities and by the endowment of the inherent physical control possessed by his creative associate.
Yeah, the creative Mother Spirit. But of course, initially, it's not the creative Mother Spirit, it's just a creative spirit in this mode. When it's just working on the physical stuff, it's before there's Mother Deity, it's just a creative spirit, just spirit deity, engaging matter. Okay, now, way back in paper 15, again, see, when we're talking about the cosmology, they mentioned something very similar here. Here they say the local universes are all approximately the same energy potential. Back there in 15, I don't know, did I mark that just in case I wanted to flip to it? I can't remember if it, no, I guess I didn't. If you go back to in paper 15 there, there they state directly that a super universe, a local universe in a super universe, a local universe is exactly 1/100,000th, okay, because there's 100,000 local universes in a super universe, that a local universe contains exactly 1/100,000th of the energy charge of a super universe. Okay, you're going, well, wait a minute, that said exactly. Here it seems to be talking about approximately. Okay, the difference is here it's, and we talked about that some back there in 15, the same issue. Here we're seeing the other side of it. It's energy potential here, or force. Force is the potential for energy. Okay, and they're gonna, I don't want to belabor it because they're going to mention it here in just a second again. But that's the difference is whether or not you're talking about a fraction of the actuality of energy or what fraction of the potentiality of energy. Okay, it's exactly that 1/100,000th when you're talking about the actuality. You know, so it's going to be approximately, you know, tied to the potential too. Okay, we'll get a little bit more here, and you see in the next paragraph, and I'll talk about the rest of it. That's what they're referring to there. And let's see, is there anything else? Just some of these details. The local universes differ greatly in physical dimensions. Even a given local universe, once it's well established, as it goes around and around the center of the super universe, its dimensions change. Remember, they pointed out, you get on the inside, when you're closer to the central universe, you're closer to the dark gravity bodies, that radically affects the structure of the super universe, and all of the local universes are kind of all more condensed and piled on top of each other. They get around out here, they're more spread out. You know, we're out here, so we're very spread out, and long ways to the next one, relatively speaking. Yep.
I guess this may sound like
go ahead.
Simplistic, but to me, I think part of the reason it's hard to explain this to some people is because now that we have the ability to look out there, these beings are obviously functioning on some kind of invisible plane because we don't see any, we don't see anything other than the stars and you know what I mean? We don't see anybody doing anything.
And the main, we're going to talk about that in a minute. I mean, the main reason that when you look out in telescopes, you don't see this is most of what we're looking out at is in the outer space levels where none of this is happening. Okay. But then when we try to look around in the Milky Way, we can't look very far. And as we're about to see, because it's so opaque, it's hard to see very far. There's too much gas and dust in the way. You can't see very far. And it's all quickly very confusing. So it's very hard for us to sort this out. Because it's so innately confusing, that's why the revelators can say so many things that they do very directly. They tell you, about this, that, and the other thing, about the structure. Because there's no way we can figure that out on our own. Okay? Yeah?
Electronic telescopes. I've seen stuff.
Well,
that is like blowing your mind.
Well,
it'd take me about 2 minutes.
Well, I mean, there's lots of. We've talked about. I don't want to get off in the cosmology here. It's not the main point of what we're doing here. But I mean, there's, if you once you have the revelation, And you know a little bit more about what you're looking for, there are some things that you start to notice that the current scientists are not picking up on. But a lot of it's pretty subtle. Remember, they tell you that even when you get much better at this, you're never going to be able to actually see two of those sectors because they're just, you know, totally on the other side of the Milky Way, and there's no way you can see through the disk and, you know, get, you know, see anything about them. But you know, there's some of these just definitive limitations. Okay, just wait a little bit, and we'll talk about that because it comes in more in context here in just a little bit. This one other thing. So about the physical dimensions, and it says, you know, they may vary in visible matter content from time to time. So you don't want to think too simplistically about this local universe being set up. It's not like every hydrogen molecule gets a nebaton tag on it, and they don't let that hydrogen molecule get outside of nebaton. That, you know, that may not be important. It can maybe drift out into another local universe, and that's okay. They are locking some things down. I mean, an inhabited solar system doesn't drift out and go to another local universe. Okay, but you know, some of the unmanaged matter, you know, is needs to still slosh around and do its own thing. So not everything is being micromanaged yet. When you finally get the grand universe settled in light and life, you know, every single automaton will be locked down, just like it is in central universe. But right now, you know, it varies a little bit. And if we read this next paragraph, you'll kind of see why it has to be sort of thought of in a little bit of a dynamic sense. You can't think of it too statically.
The energy charge of a local universe is approximately 1/100,000th of the force endowment of its super universe. In the case of Nebadon, your local universe, the mass materialization is a trifle less. Physically speaking, Nebadon possesses all of the physical endowment of energy and matter that may be found in any of the Orvontan local creations. The only physical limitation upon the developmental expansion of the Nebadon universe consists in the quantitative charge of space energy held captive by the gravity control of the associate powers and personalities of the combined universe mechanism.
Okay, so let's start with that last thing first. This is the key. The boundaries of a local universe are defined by the presence of the creative mother spirit for that local universe. So where her presence ends, it ends. But the stars and whatnot in the local universe aren't like wedged in her body. Okay. Okay. I mean, okay. She's not bejeweled literally with them. Okay. The stars of that local universe have to be held, you know, contained together in a group by the power beings. So as this thing goes around and around the center of the Milky Way, it doesn't get spread out by differential rotation and, you know, spread out all over the disk of the galaxy. They have to hold the basic matter together. Like I was saying, I mean, all of the inhabited worlds, you know, solar systems and stuff are definitely held together in a group and not allowed to stray away because of gravitational pull or differential motion or anything like that. They're held together. So that's a huge project that all these power beings, and they're using dark islands of space as gravity helpers and stuff with this to hold things together and whatnot. So you got this complicated system that's held together. And again, back to paper 15, the key thing that they're keeping exact is that you have a total force potential in the whole super universe. And they just mentioned it there. The force endowment of its super universe at the beginning of that paragraph. So you have a total energy potential, a total force endowment of a super universe. At any given point in the evolution of the superuniverse, some fraction of that potential has been actualized. Whatever amount is actualized, that actual energy, post-force, that actual energy is exactly divided up into 100,000 divisions. So they, and you notice how they refer to the physical endowment of energy and matter that may be, so Nebadon possesses all of the physical endowment of energy and matter that may be found in any of the Orvintan local creations. See, all of any. It's exactly the same. The if you total up all the energy and matter, that's the actuality. It's exactly the same in all 100,000. Okay. But, you know, then more of the total potential of the whole super universe actualizes. Now there's more actuality. You've got to change. Everyone's got to rearrange to keep it the actuality exactly 100,000th. So this is a very complicated thing. Now, exactly why we have to do this, we don't really understand. But, you know, they tell you it's exactly. So in other words, dynamically, they have to constantly dynamically readjust. The force organizers spin up another little spiral galaxy, you know, like, say, the large and small Magellanic clouds nearby to the Milky Way. Now there's more actuality in the super universe. And everyone has to adjust to that. Okay, so obviously there's going to have to, especially in the early stages, there's going to be have to be a lot of not tightly gripped matter that can go in and out to keep this balance. Okay, and eventually when all the potential is actualized, the actuality will be exactly divided up into 100,000 chunks. But it got to that final state by always being exactly divvied up, the actuality. So it's an interesting little insight into the process of managing an evolving galaxy, managing an evolving super universe. That they're keeping this actuality in tight grip of and division. Okay. And all that has to be taken into account, you know. You know, making all those, yeah, you know, we're going to get to that in a little bit here. Okay, they give you all these little details, too, that you don't, you know, I mean, they tell you that if you, in terms of the, look at the mass materialization is a trifle less, they say. So they're giving you some of these specifics. It's like not just energy and mass together, but just the mass part. Okay, so they're giving you little clues. I don't fully know why. But they're giving you little hints about where we fit into the balance here. You know, that if you wanted to see our exact 1/100,000th, you can't just look at the mass. Okay, and remember, it's that means it's going to be impossible for us to have an awareness of this. And you talk about what we can do, because we can't see any of the sub-electronic level stuff. And that's part of the exact energy distribution, all that sub-electronic level energy is being divvied up. And the power beings are most definitively engaging it rather than the mass, the stuff that's fully up to atoms and molecules that we can see and, you know, interact with. So a lot of the management, see, is happening under our radar down in the sub-electronic levels. You know, and then we have such limited visibility and confusion about the picture too. On top of that,
the beings themselves are on a plane that we can't.
Well, we tend to, we historically we use that designation of plane. Yeah, there's some validity when they talk about levels, but of course, when you're talking about power beings and what they're doing, you know, they're engaging this thing, which right now is at my eye level. You know, they're engaging matter, so it's not like they're really on a different plane. You know, in such a strong sense. It's just that the photons don't make you interact with them and make them visible to me, but they're sort of right here with us.
Okay.
You know, at our level, just of a form that we can't, you know, see. You know, as soon as we get into our next bodies, a lot of these things that are at our eye level that we can't see right now, we'll be able to see. And it's, you know, it won't be so much that we went up and now we can see them to a higher level. We'll just have a broader vision and we can see them. See, so it's more of a horizontal thing than a vertical thing. See, okay.
When you were talking about how all the different verses, systems, I guess every section of organization has to stay equal.
Yeah.
That sounds like the wholeness, that it has to be.
Right. Right. See, obviously there's something very, I mean, because that would obviously be a gigantic logistic problem. So there, you know, it must be just very fundamental for them to have to keep it exactly. I mean, the fact that they can keep it exact is a reminder that they're master force organizers.
What are you talking about now? Keep what? Yeah. What
are you talking about? It is the fraction of the energy charge of the super universe. They can exactly divvy that up into 100,000, you know, parts. I mean, obviously, only a master in such things could do that. You know? And they tell you, I mean, if they didn't have to put themselves into cooperative subordination to evolution, you know, they're master beings. They could grab a hold of it and make it locked in like the central universe, just like that. Okay, but they're not allowed to do that. But see, shades that they can do that sort of a thing is in the fact that they can take this incredible, seemingly random pile of matter that's sloshing around doing every which thing, and they somehow keep it in exact chunks, 100,000 exact chunks on the scale of hundreds of thousands of light years. Wow. I mean, how do they do that? Because they're masters.
Could you just talk about mindal energy versus material and energy matter, physical and endowment and energy matter? What is her body made of if it's not? I thought her body was, the way I perceived that was that it's where her mindal energy can reach us and we can reach it.
The most immediate way, I mean, there's two substances that a body can be made out of, matter and spirit. So if you have to pick, does she have a material body or a spiritual body? Okay, she must have a spiritual body. So she's a creative spirit. Okay, she has if you want to think about, you know, a substance for her body, it's spirit substance. So first and foremost, she's a spirit presence. There's a literal, you know, contiguous presence of spirit energy that is her body. And then within that spirit presence, as a creative spirit, she gets this mother deity, and she then can co-pervade that spirit presence with a mind presence. So she fills her body with mind. Okay? She fills the space of Nebadon with mind. Now, obviously, she was minded, so, but you know, in terms of, you know, mind that can engage a creature, she fills it with that.
You can think of her body's deity, and then she fills her deity with mind.
Yeah, I was just trying to do the matter, mind, spirit thing. I wasn't going to bring the deity part in. Obviously, she's a deity presence too. But just thinking about matter, mind, spirit, set deity aside for a second. You know, she's a spirit being. She's a creative spirit. She has a spirit body, and then. And then she just brings into that spirit body a mind that can engage creatures. Okay, in a sense, she reaches down from spirit with mind. You know, you can start to think of it in a vertical structure of spirit, you know, over mind, over matter.
Yeah, but now mix that up with the physical matter. Where's her body and where's the matter? And
okay, so like I said, you know, the stars in Nebadon. You don't want to think of them as being embedded in her body because they're matter and her body's spirit. And basically, you know, the two pass through each other. Okay? Okay? So, you know, spirit substance and material substance, you know, in and of themselves are two ships that pass in the night.
Just like you and your angel.
You know, they don't stub each other's toes. Okay? They don't bump into each other. Okay? That's what I was saying, I mean, so just the fact that she has this spirit substance, it doesn't grab a hold of the stars and drag them around. The power beings have to grab a hold of the stars and drag them around and keep them within her spirit presence. You know, they're looking, okay, there's the edge of her spirit presence. I've got to keep this guy here. Okay, they've got to keep the matter co-located with her spirit presence, with her body. Okay. Gigantic task. Got to be able to move stars around and whatnot. You got to influence vast tracts of the galaxy. Okay, what else do we have there? Did we get to, yeah, we got to that. Let's see. See, like I said, the only physical limitation upon the developmental expansion of the Nebulon universe consists in the quantitative charge of space energy held captive. Like I say, they're holding the matter captive. She doesn't capture and hold the matter captive herself. That's a separate process. Okay.
When energy matter has attained a certain stage in mass materialization, a paradise creator son appears upon the scene, accompanied by a creative daughter of the infinite spirit. Simultaneously with the arrival of the creator son, work is begun upon the architectural sphere, which is to become the headquarters world of the projected local universe. For long ages, such a local creation evolves. Suns become stabilized, planets form and swing into their orbits, while the work of creating the architectural worlds are to serve as constellation headquarters and system capitals continues.
Okay, and here, just for your reference, what they're tying into is up at the beginning of part three. So you get this neat little linkage between the beginning of part two and the beginning of part three. In section three of paper 57, that first paper of part three, remember they're giving you a little overview of the formation and evolution of a little spiral nebula that they call Andromeda. The nebula that's going to become a galaxy that's going to give rise to our sun. You know, and this little, relative to the Milky Way, this little tiny spiral galaxy is going to get incorporated into the Milky Way. And when they get to the point of talking about 400 billion years ago, 300 billion years ago, 200 billion years ago, they bring in this issue about the creator sun and creator mother spirit coming out. Okay, and they also talk about these architectural worlds. It's on the top of page 654 in the single column, right before the 300 billion year paragraph. They say it was scarcely a million years subsequent to this epoch, in other words, at 300 billion years ago, that Michael of Nebulon, a creator son of paradise, selected this disintegrating nebula as the site of his adventure in universe building. Almost immediately, the architectural worlds of Salvington and the 100 constellation headquarters groups of planets were begun. It required almost 1 million years to complete these clusters of specially created worlds. The local system headquarters planets were constructed over a period extending from that time to about 5 billion years ago. Okay, so the picture you have here, notice in the paragraph we just read in papers 32, it said simultaneously with the arrival of the creator son, they started working in the architectural worlds. Okay, so in that one, they said almost immediately the architectural worlds were, okay, the little difference between the two, you have him selecting where he's going to do his local universe, in our case, in the seventh super universe. That's going to be that little part right there. That's going to be my local universe. Then he and the creative mother spirit are going to head out to that location. They can travel very fast. So it's almost immediately that they arrive once he heads out. But technically, as they're pointing out here, the power beings don't start building those things the instant he selects. It's simultaneously when he arrives, so it's almost immediately. See, there's that little time delay, him getting out there, he and she getting out there. Okay, yeah, just a second. But once they get there, they start building Salvington and its worlds, and the 100 constellation headquarters and all their worlds. And those are all done in almost after almost a million years, short of a million years. And that's that's a lot of worlds. I mean, there's 771 for each constellation, right? And 491 for the local universe headquarters. So you got 77,500 or something like that. I mean, you got a lot of worlds there. It's all being done in about a million years.
Are you sure it's a million?
Yeah. So they said. See, that's the thing. What they say up here that takes a million years to do those. And then I'll get to you. But the other thing they point out there is. Sort of that capital and its subcapitals, the constellation, are all started right away. But the local system ones, you gotta strike step with the evolution. And with this part of Nebadon, the Andromeda Nebula part, they tell you in this paper up here, 57, that you don't have that basically all completed, its evolution. And until about 6 billion years ago. So obviously the local system headquarters, they're going to be building those. And right here when it says that it was until almost 5 billion years ago until they completed the last local system headquarters. Oh, so in other words, our part of Nebadon, the Andromeda Nebula part of Nebadon, was one of those last parts. We're getting finished right about the same time they're finishing the last local system. See, so our local, Gerasim and its worlds, were one of the last of the local system headquarters that were built, see, because of that. Because we're the straggler in the process. So the other parts of Nebadon, must have been solidly in place a lot earlier on because they tell you that the first inhabited worlds were about 200 billion years ago. So you had local systems there a lot more than 5 billion years ago. Okay, let's do this one first, anyway.
Okay. I was under the impression that a creative spirit, before she became a creative mother spirit, could actually engage the map. Now, how can she do this if she's a spirit?
Okay. So that has to do with, for the people on the webinar, he's asking about prior to being a creative mother spirit, when she's a creative spirit, he's heard me say that that the creative spirit is working with the power beings on the physical stuff. We're going to get to that in paper 34, but the answer is yes, she does. She works with the power beings. How can that be? How can a spirit being, be involved in the physical stuff so directly? And that's because. I'm just trying to look. When they talked about, isn't there a spot where they actually referred to her as a daughter of the infinite spirit? Oh, yeah, it's right there. Accompanied by a creative daughter of the infinite spirit. So that creative spirit, the daughter of the infinite spirit, and remembering that within the third source and center, within the fact of the infinite spirit, is both the power side and the personality side, both the controller side and the creator side together. So you have an ability for her to sort of be much more directly an expression of that relationship to physical things that the infinite spirit has when she's just a creative spirit. But when she, post primary eruption, see what you're discovering is when you add in the Trinity part to the spirit part, you actually get a fact now that is no longer sort of intimately related to the physical like it was before. What you recognize is that not only does she now have this mind presence associated with that spirit presence, but the spirit presence has been transformed into something that is in a way higher than it was before? The easiest way to probably visualize it is to think of the hierarchy of put matter on a level, put mind above that and spirit above that. Okay, if you don't have mind in the picture, then you know you picture some kind of spirit substance more directly engaging the physical. But if you're going to have mind there, you've got to separate the spirit from the matter, put mind in between. And that's kind of a simple way of visualizing what must have happened with her when she was transformed into a creative mother spirit. That no longer was she kind of down there with the power beings and intimate with the matter, but she's apart now as a spirit fact, because there's mind in between, intervenes in between the matter and her spirit nature. Now, I know that's still a little bit fuzzy, but it's just innately fuzzy to understand the infinite spirit and how it relates to the physical. I mean, I can't really explain that, okay? But that's the gist of it. That's what you know from what they've told you, is that prior to that, she is some kind of a being that can be more intimate with the physical. And then this changes. Right, obviously, she has a mind. Right? See, I mean, you could think about these details and try to tighten up the the fuzzy spots a little bit. But that's the gist of it, is that she's, until you have a creative mother spirit, you don't have the full threefold actuality sort of in place. You've got a precursor system. Think about the relationship of the eternal sun to the isle. That relationship is not mediated by mind. See, so on those highest levels, there's a transcendent relationship between spirit and matter. But as you downstep, that relationship isn't immediate, and it's mediated by mind. And that's, in a way, it's kind of not immediately understandable, but as a creative spirit, she's actually higher and comes down to be a creative mother spirit. But the fact that when she's higher, quote-unquote, she's actually closer to the matter. See, I suppose you'd have to understand that sort of like the other way around, see? it's a complicated thing, this, whether she's relating in the way we think is direct, where you go from spirit through mind to matter, or is she relating kind of the other way around? The way the eternal sun relates to the isle, it's not the direct way that we understand, where it has to go through mind. They're somehow related directly. You know they're related directly because the relationship actually gives rise to a circuit of worlds of the eternal sun. So that's an expression of that relationship, you see, and that didn't occur through the mediation of mind. So, see, all those complicated details are in play with that, understanding that. Well, let's see here. We're probably not going to get all the way through this. Yep.
My question or comment is similar to Gene's, but slightly different, because we've always thought that the creator sun is the creator mm-hmm. of the local universe, and with the help of the creative daughter of the infinite spirit.
Right.
And the work doesn't start until they get there. But they're not doing the work. So if I was going to try to explain this to someone in a more down-to-earth, simplistic manner, and I'm not trying to be funny here.
No.
I think I'd say something like, say there was a construction project, and the workers were there, but they didn't start until the project director showed up. The project director mm-hmm. told them what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Is that too silly of a...
It's not, and I think we'll just, why don't we talk about this for a little bit longer and not try to even get into the next okay. section, but Let me just pull out something from the next section and talk about this a little bit. If you glance down in the next section, the third paragraph in, you'll see a comment about a little over 1 billion years in that third paragraph. Mm-hmm. Okay. Just let me just pull that out. And what that's referring to is, we'll see when we actually talk about it in detail next time. There's this whole precursor phenomenon to the creator Son and the creative Mother Spirit directing it like you're describing. Before the creator Son and creative Mother Spirit are intimately directing things, the architects of the master universe are directing the process.
And it says the work doesn't begin until they
right,
got there.
Right, but as we see when we get to this, this billion years thing is before the Creator, Son, and the Creator, Mother, Spirit arrive, basically.
Okay.
Okay? Things are going on. So let me just give you the bigger picture. When you think about our local universe of Nebadon, as we get into the next section, they'll remind us that it's a definite just fraction of the total of Nebadon. That Andromeda Nebula is just a fraction of the total local universe. Think about that part that gave rise to our sun, the Andromeda Nebula. So it starts out as an independent little whirl outside, so here's the Milky Way galaxy, and way off over here, outside of the disk, away from the Milky Way, the force organizers spin up a little whirl called the Andromeda Nebula. And it starts to coalesce into ultimatons, and eventually you have stars and everything, and it becomes a little spiral galaxy. Okay, that's all outside of the immediately managed area of major sectors, minor sectors, local universes. Right? It's in those outer domains of the super universe. Okay, but definitely once it's that little galaxy is a mass, and the Milky Way is definitely a mass, two masses attract each other, linear gravity. As soon as that thing is formed, it starts being drawn in gravitationally towards the Milky Way. And then, you recognize that this is just a part. You've got a whole bunch of other stuff that's apparently also had been made is coming in. And there may be stuff that hasn't been used down in the disk yet, too. And this stuff all pools together, and then they start carving it out. They start roughing out local universes down in the disk of the galaxy, using stuff that just came in, like that little Andromeda Nebula, and stuff that was already sloshing around in there and hasn't gotten used yet. And they start to rough out local universes. And they'll have a few local universes roughed out, in a particular super universe, and the creator son looks out and he goes, I want that one out there. All it is a frame. There's no, siding or sheetrock or anything. Okay. It's just the rough frame of a local universe out there. And I picked that one. Okay. And then he goes out there and he works on the finishing work. He directs the finishing work. But roughing it out is all directed by beings higher than him. And sort of the immediate precursor phase of getting it from, what is really not even appropriately called roughed out, but just kind of still coming together and stuff by gravity and whatnot, not even being managed. Once it's basically when gravity's brought things together and the power beings really get in there and start managing it, they tell you it takes them about 1 billion years to kind of get it really roughed out so that it's ready to start building architectural worlds in it. You can't start building architectural worlds, if it's still just a chaotic pile of galaxies and stuff that have clumped together. And you got to get it kind of roughed out because you're going to make all 100 constellation headquarters. You got to have it, pretty solid here. It can't be a very chaotic thing.
Free of dark gravity body. influences.
Well, it, not dark gravity bodies, but dark islands of space. But it's not free of those. I mean, it's not chaotic. They got to bring those under control. They're going to use those dark islands of space to help anchor this thing and get it less chaotic, get it stable enough that you can say, okay, so here's going to be the 100 constellations, you know, and that's not going to randomly be sloshing around. It's going to be, you know, pretty. But, you know, you're still going to have supernovas going off and, you know, and nebulae collapsing and forming stars. And all that's going to be, I mean, you know, think about that process that you've got inhabited worlds in Nevadon 200 billion years ago. You know, and that whole, so, there, you know, while those worlds are inhabited and getting settled in light and life over billions of years, at the same time, you know, in their neighborhood, you have the Andromeda Nebula still spewing out stars and, you know, and not getting complete until just 5 billion years ago.
It's an ongoing process.
Right, so...
But you do agree that the architectural sphere were in an area that was stabilized sufficiently before the world... You know, before the evolutionary worlds, et cetera, were formed, and like I said before, it'd take me probably 2 minutes at the minimum to describe how I had seen, not on a optical, but on a radio telescope, the in New Mexico, the radio telescope that they have 100 different 200 ton telescopes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean.
They have a bunch of radio telescopes. Yeah.
He's a physicist. He knows.
Well, help me. Is it 49?
I don't remember the number. Okay, it doesn't matter. They have a number of radio telescopes.
Are 21 anyway? Each one weighs 200 tons, and they're on three rail tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see about 3 decades ago. This image on the TV screen outside the control center of how they are, it's like a perfect cube with the corners knocked off, so it's somewhat spherical. And at each point, not of a cube, but this more rounded thing, there's clusters of these physically, I mean optically perhaps invisible, because it says...
Right, on
page 16 of the index.
Right.
But you have this image of clusters of light sources.
Right.
Radio, not.
Right.
And they taper in, and then they get congested at each of these points on the spherical, faceted.
Okay, I mean, I can't speak directly to that because I don't know exactly what you're describing there, but
it's hollow, and you can see.
It's you know, you may actually be describing something that's vastly bigger than the space we're talking about.
It's kind of close. Within the constellation.
Since we don't have the facts, we can't speak to it directly. Okay, but let me just speak generally about think about trying to match up what the revelators are saying here with things that astronomers can present you a picture of, either with, you know, radio in radio waves or visible waves, infrared, ultraviolet, whatever, X-ray, whatever you know, wavelength they're using to give you an image. You can think very directly about that issue of, well, what if I'm looking at a radio wave image? Am I possibly seeing architectural worlds? Okay, there's two problems that you'll immediately, you know, confront if you try to follow that line of thought. One, the architectural worlds are not going to be radio sources. They're not going to be radio wave sources.
They're not going to be heat sources either, right?
There'll be some heat, but they're very far away, so they're not going to be a very definitive heat source, you know, from a long distance away.
They don't get heat from stars.
No, you get heat from stars, and you get heat from you. I mean, the architectural spheres, if they were cold, if there wasn't heat coming from the beings on them, would freeze.
If they don't get heat from stars, they get heat from other sources.
Okay, right, but they get heat. Okay, you asked if an architectural world would be a heat source. Yes, it is. If I was in the proximity of an architectural world and I had my infrared goggles on, but I'm just trying to explain. I could see an architectural world as an infrared source because it's definitely gonna be giving off infrared because it's not stone cold. Right. It's not at absolute zero, or the material beings would freeze to death on it.
Right.
Okay. Now the other issue that you got to keep in mind, and you're thinking about, if you see an astronomical image that seems to have a lot of pattern in it, and you're wondering, that looks like a lot of artificial pattern. I wonder if that's the artificiality of architectural worlds, perhaps. Definitely, if it's radio that you're talking about, you may have a problem with. Where the scale of what you're observing is vastly bigger than the scale of architectural worlds. You know, that you'd be if you figured out what the scale of what you're seeing is, it seems to have some pattern in it, you know, and let's say it's this big. If you overlaid architectural worlds on that image, they'd be a dot. You know, so obviously their pattern is not whatever pattern you're seeing at this scale. When you're dealing with longer and longer wavelengths of light, more and more into the radio waves, you're fundamentally, observing things that have a bigger scale. Okay? There's all these scientific and technical questions that you have to, begin to carefully think about.
Well, what would be really helpful for me is to jump up to a bigger picture. It is said that we can only see so much of, call it inhabited space.
Mm-hmm.
Are we talking about we could only see much of our local super universe, or parts of those other super universes that are on this side?
So let's talk about that a little bit. Yeah, that'll help with this context. These are sort of like general questions that we could just talk about a little bit rather than getting into this next section. This is a great thing to do. Just talk about some of these basic image ideas. So let's set this scale a little bit. If you go to a very dark part of the country, go out in the country somewhere away from the city so you can see the night sky really clearly. You're looking at all these stars in the night sky.
You're going to get to the radio telescope, right?
Hold on. Okay, just to set the stage a little bit. If you're looking at all these stars in the night sky, okay, what exactly am I looking at relative to the cosmology of the Urantia book? Am I looking at the seven super universes? What am I looking at? What do all those stars in the night sky represent? In the darkest place where I can see, the farthest I can see and whatnot. Okay, with the naked eye, basically what you're seeing, all those stars are just in the local universe of Nebulon. With the naked eye, there's no way that you're penetrating really beyond the confines of just the local universe of Nebulon. So you think about the whole Milky Way galaxy. If I break it up into 100,000 pieces, so just take any picture, that you visualize in your mind of a galaxy, a spiral galaxy, break it up into 100,000 little chunks. Okay, those are pretty tiny little chunks. Okay, you'd have to draw really little circles on your paper. Okay, that's how small relative, a local universe is to the full size of the Milky Way. Okay, and that's basically all you can see your naked eye. Now, if you get a telescope and just start trying to look at more stars that are too dim to see with the naked eye, now you're going to start to penetrate beyond the local universe domain. You're going to start to see stars that are in neighboring local universes, so that are surrounding Nebulon. But as long as you're still trying to look within the disk of the Milky Way, you're not going to get very far. Because even with the most powerful telescope, visible telescope, starting with here, with a visible telescope, when you try to look very deep into the disk of the Milky Way, there gets to be so much gas and dust that your vision goes opaque. And you can't see very far. Okay, so with trying to see with visible light, there's no way you can remotely get any sense of minor sectors, major sectors, any of that big scale sort of stuff. It's just going to be a hodgepodge of things that you can kind of see. It's like, oh, in between these two opaque clouds, I can see some stars here that are a little farther away and this sort of stuff. Okay? Now you can see the band of the Milky Way, so you know where the plane of the disk is of the Milky Way galaxy. And you can tell where the central bulge of that is, you know, where basically the direction to the center is in that disk. Now, if you go to longer wavelengths, like if you go to radio waves, and you do the same thing. You start to try to look out into the disk of the galaxy. Well, for instance, one of the ways that you can start to see very far beyond where our location is if you're looking at hydrogen, just hydrogen gas. Okay. It emits a characteristic wavelength that you can start to pick up in the radio telescopes. And so you can start to figure out maybe what the distribution is of that mass, of that hydrogen gas that you can see with radio telescopes. Well, again, you're not going to see any of this structure.
Which structure?
I'm just about to finish the sentence. This structure that we're reading about here, where we have all this, like, you know, literally, they tell you that the major sectors are 10 pi wedges. That if you were to take a spaceship up and look down on the Milky Way, you'd see 10 pi wedges. Okay, they tell you you could also go, oh, there's that minor sector, there's that one, there's that one, there's that one. You can literally see the minor sectors and the major sectors clearly.
Like Byron's painting?
Well, I mean, he doesn't break the super universes up into pi wedges and stuff like major sectors and minor sectors. But, you know, they tell you you could see those divisions. Well, but what has that structure? Is it the uncontrolled hydrogen gas in the galaxy? No. I mean, it's not even in general the stars. It's only the inhabited worlds and stuff that are... And their solar systems that are going to express this this control and this artificial structure very definitively. So if all you're looking at is hydrogen gas, you'll see long past where you can see visually, but you won't see any of this structure because, like I said, the hydrogen molecules don't have local universe labels on them; they aren't being managed and kept. You know, so for instance. You might see just very smooth spirals, arm structure, and stuff like that.
Too much information.
Okay, but none of that is tied to this. See, so there's all these details. If you want to think about this stuff, there's nothing trivial. You have to have you got to approach it at a PhD level of understanding of astronomy and physics and the Urantia book. Okay, because there's nothing trivial about what they're saying here. I mean, it's basically, everything they're telling you here can't be observed. That's why they can tell you it. If it could be observed, it couldn't be in here. Okay, so just think about that. Think about how... So you take everything that's observed, and it's basically a disjoint set from everything that's talked about in here. Because that's why it's in here. Because we can't observe it. If we can observe it and figure it out, the mandate doesn't allow them to put it in here. So... And then on top of that, the stuff that we can observe, we are very ignorant about some of the basic issues, and so we have all kinds of false deductions about what we're seeing. I mean, an awful lot of what you read in an article, a scientific article, is not just describing what a picture looks like. You know, they don't give you a picture and then spend 20 pages saying, and there's one star that's here, and then if you go 2 inches up, you know, that's not what the article is about, is describing the picture. The article is about... well, and this picture means blah, blah, blah. You know, and if you know the Urantia book, you go, no, that picture doesn't mean that. Okay. You think that picture means that because you have a false initial assumption that you're using to interpret that picture. If you take the correct assumptions of the revelation, you get a totally different interpretation of what that picture is. So there's that problem.
Let me interject question and you continue on after.
Well, here we're going to have to wrap up if we go to you. Okay.
With where your head's at. Are we going to get to this thing about the radio telescopes, or are we already beyond my question about the radio?
Well, there's nothing I can say really directly about that right now. I mean, if you want me, you know, offline.
Well, yeah, you can. You can explain to me. Are we seeing more than one?
Go ahead.
Is it possible to see more than?
You can see more
in super universe. Can you see? Or is it?
No.
Can you see five of them, and the other two are blocked up?
No. You can't.
That would be most helpful.
You can't, even with radio telescopes and things, we can't see the other six super universes.
Okay. So that means what I was describing has to be more local than the super universe.
Well, it all depends on whether or not what you're describing is actually a local picture or if it's some picture that's showing you the outer space levels. See, offline, you know, over the years, lots of people have done this. They find something, you know, on the internet, they see an article about a recent discovery, and they say, Chris, what is this, you know, what does this mean?
what I'm asking about?
Yeah, right. I mean, that sort of thing. Right? So, just to leave it, you know, because we've got to wrap it up here, it's 9:30. But just, you know, recognizing that, I'm certainly willing to help people with some of these issues, but I can tell you right up front, work on this some yourself. You know, begin to appreciate that there's never going to be anything trivial about relating some picture or some observation that's being described by a scientist with what's in the revelation. This is a very, very complex task. I mean, it's complicated enough to just relate one passage in the Revelation to another passage. Like, why does it say exactly 100,000 in this paragraph and it says approximately in this one? Mm-hmm. Okay? Just that process takes a lot of careful, you know, parsing and thinking about it. And so, you just keep that in mind. You're never going to get a scientific press release of anything that's in here very directly. It's just not going to happen. Okay. Most likely, unfortunately, if the press release is very exciting, it's because it's totally false. Okay. Again, simply because you read this and it sounds very exciting with all its pattern and structure and all that, but all of this can be given to us because you can't observe that. See, so you're just not going to get that from direct observation. They're telling you so you know, and we'll get into that a little bit more. You see, universe organization. See, is the next section. Obviously, that's going to come up a little bit when we get into this next section. Thinking more about how complicated this is to relate. There's the only way you can begin to relate scientific observations with the revelation is if you know all of the assumptions that go into scientific discourse, you know, and can take that into account. You can't take anything that a scientist says at face value and then try to relate it to the revelation. If you could take what the scientist says at face value, you wouldn't need the revelation. What the scientist is saying would be a revelation, of truth. But it's not. It's a pronouncement of ignorance by and large. You know, and same way with religionists. You can't take anything that a religionist says at face value. Like we said at the beginning, the fifth epical revelation is addressing our ideas. And they can write all this stuff about our ideas because basically all of our ideas are false. We have some true relationship to ideals. you know, or even a threefoldness with the ideals of truth, beauty, and goodness. But you notice when you say truth, beauty, of goodness, one of those three words is not fact. So what about facts? You know, like what about what those scientists are, you know, are writing about in their articles? They're not writing about truth, beauty, and goodness. They're writing about facts. How do I relate this to facts? All kinds of awareness of truth, beauty, and goodness can't help me relate to the facts of the scientists. It takes a different kind of truth. See, the thing that swapped out is beauty. Instead of having beauty, you put in fact. And that changes the kind of truth. We're going to wrap up here. I just want to, you know, and we can talk a little bit afterwards here. But just, you see, that you know, I've tried to stress that. That's the very complicated thing that's going on with the fifth epical revelation, is that we're trying to engage a different type of truth than Jesus was trying to get us to engage. Jesus was trying to get us to engage a kind of truth that relates to beauty and existential goodness. The fifth epical revelation is trying to get us to relate to the kind of truth that relates to facts and experiential goodness, perfectingness. Okay, it's a very different thing, and it's very, very hard and very, very complicated, and it's fraught with endless pitfalls. Okay. All right, so we'll get into a little bit more of this next time. Let's take a moment. We can talk some more afterwards here too. Let's take a moment to reflect on it.